get moving so we can get out early. That'll hush the room. Okay. Few more things we need to take a look at before we can wrap up for the night. We have the education tax credits. Now, there's a big difference between credits and deductions. We'll talk more about this, obviously, when we get to income tax. But a deduction reduces the amount of income that's subject to tax. A credit reduces the tax. So all else equal, a credit's more valuable than a deduction. If you're in the 33% tax bracket, for example, and you have a dollar of credit, that's the equivalent of $3 of deduction. Because if you deduct $3 from your income at a 33% tax rate, that saves you a dollar, right? So if you have a dollar of credit, that's the equivalent of $3 of deduction. So the fact that these are credits is pretty significant. A lot of times when we use credits in tax policy, they're used to try and equalize the benefit across income strata so that everybody gets the same benefit instead of having a greater benefit go to the higher income people. If we use a deduction, who gets the best benefit from that? The higher income people. Because they're paying the highest tax rate, so they get the highest tax benefit from having a deduction. When we use a credit, we equalize it across income schemes so that everybody gets the same benefit. Now, the two credits we have available are the American Opportunity Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. The one that you're going to see probably most often will be this American Opportunity Credit because it's available for the first 4 years of undergraduate education. That changed. This used to be the HOPE Credit. And some of you may know about that HOPE credit. It used to be only for the first 2 years. They've extended it to 4 years when they changed the name. So the limit is $2,500 per student. Part of it can be what's called a refundable credit. And this means that even if you have no tax liability, the IRS will send you a check at the end of the year if you qualify for this credit. So if you have no tax liability, you didn't pay anything in, and this credit applies, the government sends you a check. Pretty good deal. That's what a refundable credit means. Most credits are non-refundable, which means if you don't have tax liability to offset, you don't get any benefit. So this is a very powerful credit, and it's designed primarily for that moderate income group, as I mentioned, because the AGI limits apply. Now, one other thing that's important to know, and we'll cover this in more detail and all the technical requirements of this when we look at the income tax rules in the third course, but if you are convicted of a drug-related offense, you cannot take the American Opportunity Credit. It used to be better when it was the HOPE Credit, because I could say, if you use the dope, you have no hope, or something like that. But now it's American Opportunity Credit. If you have a drug-related offense, you can't take that. But you can still take the Lifetime Learning Credit if you want to. Apparently, druggies are permitted to do this, but not that. So Lifetime Learning Credit is available for life, as the name implies, and it can apply to either graduate or undergraduate education. And this is a family limit of $2,000 per year, and limits apply. In order to get that $2,000 credit, though, you have to spend $10,000 in educational expenses. In order to get the $2,500 American Opportunity Credit, you only have to spend about $4,000. So all else equal, the American Opportunity Credit will get you a bigger tax benefit quicker. So that's the first one that you're going to use if it applies to you. So those are the education tax credits. Here's the Series EE bonds. A few people asked about those during the break and even during class. Remember, the significance of this is the interest is tax-free as long as you purchase them when you were at least 24 years old, and you redeem them to pay for educational costs. If you do that and you meet the income thresholds, the income guidelines, the interest on those Series EE bonds won't be subject to tax. Now, the interest is already not subject to state tax, and now it won't be subject to federal tax if these requirements are met. The biggest problem with these, though, remember, is that if you have these bonds, you're probably not keeping up with inflation and taxes. On an inflation and tax-adjusted basis, you're losing spending power every year. So given that educational inflation is 6%, and you're losing real purchasing power by holding these assets, this is not the best type of investment to consider for educational costs. Yes, you can. It's right, there'll be a gift, and I think that will also... That will also trigger some tax consequences, but I have to think about that. Never had anybody do that, so. but you could do that. And the biggest hurdle most of you and most of your clients will have with this is the income limit's very low. If you're a single individual and you have more than about $70,000 of income, you can't do this. And if you're married and you have more than about $110,000 of income jointly, you can't do this. So there's a big, in this as well as in many other areas of tax law, there's a marriage penalty. Married couples don't get two times what single couples have available. They get stuck with more taxes. So anyway, that's the Series E bonds. If you have them, use them for that purpose. If you don't buy them for this purpose. There are better ways of funding.
For the American Opportunity Tax Credit, I think you have to spend $4,000. What if you're going to take out like student loans?
Well, a student loan counts as a payment because you're going to have to pay that back with after-tax dollars. So that counts. Yeah. Even if you have it fully leveraged, you fully leverage your education, you can still take this credit. Now, if you got a full ride to the college and you didn't have to pay anything, you can't take it because there's no out-of-pocket expense. But as long as you had the loans, that's fine. All right, the student loan interest deduction, we mentioned this too. You can deduct up to $2,500 above the line. When we get to income tax, you'll see that there are different ways we can take deductions. And the best way to take a deduction is called an above the line deduction, which reduces your adjusted gross income. And that has some magic effects because AGI is used as the measuring threshold for a lot of other items in income tax. So the lower we can make AGI, usually the better off we are. So from a tax standpoint anyway, not obviously we don't want to tell somebody to wipe out their income, right? That's not going to go too far. But you can get up to $2,500 above the line, and if you go over the AGI limits, you can't take it anymore. So again, most of your clients probably are not going to qualify. The qualified higher education expenses have expired. We left this in here because this is one of those things that you constantly hear talk about in the campaigns and in Congress. They talk about possibly extending these provisions. Up until the end of 2009, you could take up to $4,000 of educational expenses above the line. So that's the tuition cost. You just take it as an above the line tax deduction up to $4,000 if you met the AGI limits. And the AGI limits here are higher because there are lots of congressmen that had kids in school when this was initially passed. And the AGI limits were set so that most of the congressmen, based on their salary, could take this deduction. So the thresholds are a little higher in this case. But it's gone now, and unless they extend it, we won't see that again. So hopefully they'll extend it. That'll be good for the clients. Now, other funding is usually private-based funding. The first one, I already mentioned some of the problems here, the UGMA and the UPMA accounts, Uniform Gifts to Minors or Transfers to Minors Act accounts. Different states have different paradigms. The Uniform Transfer is the more modern version of that. But essentially, a minor can't own property. If you're under the age of 18, you're not legally permitted to conduct business or to own property. So if you're going to give something to a minor, that has to be held either in trust for the minor or a guardian has to hold it for the minor, and that's why we use these accounts. So this is why when you go down to the bank and you set up a bank account for your kids, is it just your kid's name on the account? No, there has to be an adult's name on the account as well who acts as the guardian for the child. So even though you may not have realized it, when you set up that bank account, that was an UGMA or UPMA account with the bank. Now, when you put money into these accounts, you have made a gift to the child. And there might be gift tax consequences depending on the circumstances and the exclusions that are available. But when you make the gift, the money now belongs to the kid. It's not your money anymore. You can't take it back. And under UGMA and UPMA provisions, usually the child gets to have access to that money when they reach the legal age of majority, which in most states is 18. And most people probably don't like the prospect of having an 18-year-old suddenly have access to $500,000 or $1 million. It might not be the best move you make with your family's finances. So there might be other options you could consider. You could set up various types of trusts miners' trusts, crummy trusts that will allow you to control that money for a longer period of time, and in some cases all the way throughout the lifetime of the child, so that they can't use the money inappropriately. But we'll talk about that in other classes and some of the other tools you can use. If you transfer the money to these accounts, though, remember, that's money that the child has. It's fully available to pay for education, and it's going to increase the expected family contribution when we start to look at financial aid. So any direct transfers to the kid are going to reduce your ability to get financial aid for education. It's that simple. The employer-provided educational assistance. This is neat. Under this provision, employers can have what we would call an educational reimbursement plan, usually, that will pay up to $5,250 of education costs that will be deductible by the employer as an employee benefit and will not be included in the income of the employee. So this violates a very basic rule of income tax. Usually for income tax purposes, in order for somebody to take a deduction for something, somebody else better be showing income somewhere in the system. When we have one of these plans in place, the employer deducts the costs, and then it never shows up in anybody's income. And this is because we're trying to encourage people to take advantage of this and encourage employers to provide this benefit. Now, that $5,250 is misunderstood a little bit. This applies to general education. So when you have an employee who wants to go back and get a bachelor's degree and needs to take art appreciation and music history and all of those courses that are necessary to obtain the degree that aren't related to the trade or business, that's what you're paying for under this. If the employee is taking courses that are directly related to the trade or business or to enhance their skills in their current trade or profession, those are deductible without regard to the amount. So, for example, if you're a manager of a company and the company says you're going to get an MBA, we want you to have an MBA if you're going to run this office, so we're going to pay you to get an MBA and it's going to cost $20,000 a year for the next couple of years and we'll pay it directly, that's not taxable to you because all of that training is directly related to your trade or profession and it's a training cost for the company. If the company provided the training, it would be deductible. So if they have the training provided through a university, that's deductible by the company as well. So this limit usually applies to that general education fund. And this is one of the benefits that the business owners can have. You have a small business without a lot of employees. Let's say you're a single member shop. And you have a secretary who you know isn't interested in going back to school. You might have somebody answering the phones or something. And then your kid is getting up to the age where they're ready to enter school. You hire them to work at the business, set up one of these plans, offer it on a non-discriminatory basis. There's only one person to take advantage of it, though, so they take advantage of it. You get to deduct $5,250 off the top of your business income, which means you don't pay income tax, you don't pay Social Security tax on that amount, and your kid never shows that $5,250 in their income. Can be a very powerful way of funding part of the education. Question, back in the back.
The case we were just discussing right now, if the employer is the one mandating or demanding for higher education to be achieved in the same field, but if it's not the employer, the one
yes.
As to whether it's something permissible or not, right?
Yes. Yeah. If it's the employee's initiative, then there's a question of whether or not it's really necessary for an ordinary necessary and reasonable business expense, right? So, but generally, if the employer says you have to have this, I want you to have this because you're going to manage this office, and the classes you're going to take are all directly related to what you're doing in your job function. It doesn't have to be limited by the $5,250. That's what we would call training. We call those training costs, and they'd be fully deductible. Now, there's a limitation on this as well. If you're able to enter a new trade or profession, then you can't deduct the cost at all. So let's say that you're a paralegal working at a law firm. You're working in a legal environment. You're doing all this stuff that you're doing most of the stuff that lawyers do. You just can't sign off on the on the documents in a lot of cases, and you go to law school at night, you can't deduct any of the costs of that education. And if the employer provided it for you, if they paid for it for you, that would have to show up in your income. Because as a result of going to law school, you're now going to be licensed to practice law. You're entitled to sit for the bar. You can practice law. That's entering a new trade or profession, even if you're in the same industry. So when you need a license to practice, so physicians, lawyers, accountants, CPAs, those types, those costs to obtain those licenses for practice are not deductible at all.
Can the business owner be included as an employee for that exclusion for income?
Well, if the business owner, if you have a C corporation, yes. If you have something else, probably not, because the business owner would be considered self-employed.
So then it would just be a regular business.
Right. So really wouldn't be applying to the business owner, him or herself. But it doesn't matter. Not really, because usually those costs are going to be related to what you're going to be doing in the business, right? So you can deduct all of those costs as training-related expenses.
So.
No, this is where the company pays for education, and it never shows up in the income of the employee.
Okay.
So it's not a credit, it's just something that disappears from the system. The company incurs the expense, gives a benefit to the employee, but the employee doesn't have to pay the tax on the benefit.
So I guess twofold is the question then. Let's say you had you hired your child as an employee of the company.
Mm-hmm.
You want to send them to private school. Could you do it for prior to undergrad, and then could you pay for, let's say your kid was going to go into business school, could you pay for that completely?
I think that's, well,
kind of both.
All right, if it's elementary or secondary, that's a bit of a stretch, because you're not going to have too many 8-year-olds working at the company, right?
Well, I'm saying 16-year-old.
Well, yeah, that's a bit of a stretch, I think. If we're doing it for college-related costs, I think you're okay. But even if they go off to business school, until they get their first degree, they're going to have to take all those generic-type courses, right? All the general education courses to get that bachelor's degree, because presumably when you get a bachelor's degree, you're a well-rounded person, right? You all remember all that general education that you took in your undergraduate programs, I assume, all that culture and experience you got to go through. Well, in theory, we're producing that well-rounded person, so that's what this would be for. The direct business costs would be deductible directly.
So it had to be only $5,200 a year, pretty much.
Well, $5,200 for English and for history and art appreciation and music history and all of those kinds of things, but then. If the kid's taking care of the books and they're taking accounting classes, the accounting classes are directly related to the trade or profession, they're deductible. If the kid's doing something in the finance area, the finance classes are deductible, and so on. So
if you are a company, you're paying this, and you pay, say, $6,000 for you to go to school, would that additional $750 show up on your W-2?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. If you go over that limit, the excess would be in the W-2. So it's kind of like phantom income. Now, is that a good deal for the employee? It's a tremendous deal for the employee, because they're not paying anything out of pocket. And all that's happening is, in your example, the $750 shows up in their income. So what do they really have to pay? The tax on the $750. So they're getting the education at, say, 20% of the cost of the education, because they're not out of pocket for the full amount. They're only out of pocket for the tax on the amount that was paid for by the employer. So that's still a great deal for the employee in those circumstances.
How much does a kid have to work to be called?
Well, for this kind of stuff, they'd be full-time.
But
yeah. Yeah.
What if your employer offers to pay for student loans after you've already gone to school? How is that?
Okay, well, generally that will be a form of compensation you receive by working, And anytime you receive something, whether it's cash or property or debt relief, as a consequence of working, that should be considered income, unless we can find something in the code that excludes it from the definition of income. So if you, let's go back to the example we were talking about before with the teachers. So these people go through school, they become teachers, and then they work in an underprivileged area for a period of time, and we forgive their loans. Because that's public policy related, they're not going to have income as a result of that loan forgiveness. But if the employer just pays back the student loans as part of compensation, that would probably be taxable. So it depends. If it's a government program, then the rules might be. The government has completely different sets of rules from the private sector. So when you're looking at government employees, there probably are tons of exclusions that are not available otherwise. Okay. Other questions? All right. Now, home equity lines of credit. Again, we'll talk about this in more detail when we get to income tax, but when you have equity in your home, one way of paying education expenses would be to tap into that equity. Theoretically, the only interest you can deduct on a home equity loan is the interest on the first $100,000 of home equity indebtedness. If you have more than $100,000 of home equity indebtedness, you can't deduct the interest on that additional amount. Now, that's the rule. That's how the system is supposed to work. How many of you do your own taxes? Okay, wow, quite a few. That's unusual. Most of the time, only a few hands go up. Most people go to an accountant, or they go to H&R Block or somebody to have their taxes done. When you sit down with the accountant, does the accountant ask you what the outstanding balance of your mortgage is? When you get to the deductions and you're looking at home mortgage interest and home equity lines of credit, have any of you that go to accountants ever been asked that question? No. In reality, even though we have these limits, they're not really enforced. What does the accountant do? They take the little form that the bank sends that says you paid this amount in interest, and they just plop it in the tax return. They just put it right in. They don't consider how much of that interest is attributable to the first $100,000, or if it's acquisition indebtedness, the first $1 million. But we'll talk about that later. On the exam, when you get to CFP exam, you got to follow the rules as they were intended to work, not the rules that we use in practice. Sometimes those are two different things.
If you get audited on that, I guess that line, mm-hmm. is that the tax preparer's fault, or is it your fault?
It's kind of a combination of both, but the tax preparer is always going to say it's your fault because you didn't tell them. They prepared it based on the information you gave them, and you didn't give them the information, so therefore it's your fault. So that's typically how they'll do it. I've never seen anybody get audited on that, and I'm sure there might have been a couple of. Now, if somebody comes along and has $250,000 of home equity and interest or something like that, because they have a monster house and a big home equity loan, obviously that will set off a red flag. But for most people, if they have $200,000 in debt on home equity and they're claiming $10,000 of interest, that's nobody's going to question that at all. So that's why it slips by all the time. Okay, so those were the other sources of funding. Any other questions on the education funding? Now tomorrow, what we're going to do is time value, obviously in the morning. We'll talk about these time value concepts. I'll give you a little bit of a theoretical underpinning, and then we'll do some problems. It sometimes helps to understand what's behind these calculations. When you get to the exam, all you have to know how to do is push the right buttons. So ultimately, that's what you want to get to develop the skill set to do, at least to get through the exam, is push the right buttons. Now, when we look at the time value problems, there are several different calculations we're going to do. We're going to do present value calculations and future value calculations, and we're going to determine interest rates and time periods and look at annuities and all kinds of things. When we're looking at this from a practical standpoint, from a planning perspective, sometimes you have to combine those techniques to get to the right answer. So for example, with an education funding problem, let's say that you know it's going to cost, if you want your kid to go to Notre Dame, That's been you. That's where, that was your alma mater. That was your father's alma mater. That's where your kid's going to go. Going to be another one of the Fighting Irish, right? Going to go to Notre Dame, and it costs $50,000 a year to go to Notre Dame. Your kid's just born today. How can we figure out how much we need to have when they're age 18 in order to fully fund their education? What will we have to do? Well, if it costs $50,000 today, is that the cost going to? Is that what the cost is going to be in 18 years? What's the cost going to be in 18 years? It's going to be a lot more than $50,000, right? So we'd inflate it at the education inflation rate of 6%, and that'll be the cost for the first year. Is that the cost for all 4 years? No. So we could figure out the cost for the first year, then we could figure out the cost for the second, third, and fourth, right? And then we could take those 4 years and present value them back to the beginning of college, and that would tell us the lump sum that we'd need the day they graduate to pay for their whole education at Notre Dame. And then once we have that number, we could bring that back to today to figure out how much we'd have to put aside today so that that amount of money accumulated at a certain rate of return would get us to that point. Or we could, if we have no money, which is more likely the case, most clients, right, don't have oodles of money sitting around with nothing to do with the money. They usually are employing it somewhere, and they don't have a lot of excess cash flow. That's reality. So how are we going to get to the point where they have that lump sum? They're going to have to save over time. So we could calculate the amount they need to save on an annual basis or a monthly basis or a weekly basis so that that savings plus the growth will get you to that point. Now, if you think about that process, I went through that quickly, but I think most of you kind of followed that conceptually. That involves several different time value calculations. When you look at education funding or retirement funding calculations, people get scared because it looks like it's some big complex thing and there are all these little formulas that you have to apply. All it really is a couple of those time value calculations put together. So all you have to do is think through what you're trying to do, figure out what applies, and then you can easily come to the answer. And once you do a few education funding and retirement funding calculations, you'd be able to do them quickly. A lot of people in the review courses will tell you if you ever get one of those on the exam, well, you skip that question. You guess at it, and you do all the other questions, then you come back to that at the end. But if you get practiced enough in this, you can answer it in 30 seconds, so why are you going to skip it? Right? Why not just pick up the points and then move on? So hopefully that by the end of the day, we'll be looking at some of those types of problems after we cover the simple time value issues in the morning. Please bring your calculators tomorrow. I hope you all have a calculator of some sort. If you don't, we can still do this. It's very easy. it's just a couple of simple formulas. It's nothing that complex, but it's a lot easier if you can just push a couple of buttons. So tomorrow, what I would like to do, though, and if any of you want to volunteer for this purpose, if you are familiar with using your particular calculator and doing time value, let me know, because I want to set all of you up in groups based on the calculators that you have. And I'd like to have at least one person in each of those groups that has some background in doing the financial calculations on that, because I think that'll make it easier for everybody else to learn how to do this. So if you volunteer, let me know tomorrow morning. Any other questions? Anything else you'd like to go over? Tomorrow we probably will get out a little bit early. Yeah.
What time are we starting?
8:15 is that seems to be the start time most of the classes prefer. Let's start at 8:15. We'll do the time value. We'll probably be out by, I would think, about 2 to 2:30, unless we can stay longer. We can always stay longer. That's not a problem. Time value is 6. Yeah.
And in here.
And right. This is the most important. This is much better. The chapter is more theoretical.
From 93, starting about page 27 or something.